The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I started last week on this theme of love and relationship, sexuality, dharma, and continue that. You know, my vision of a kind of good love, and love in this specifically in a kind of relational, romantic sense, would be something like the union of Eros and Metta. The union of a kind of passion and kindness and tenderness. And a lot of times it's easier to have one or the other. And I think Freud says something like, where one loves, there one cannot desire. Where one desires, one cannot love. Now that's a kind of too radical, I think. But there, that sometimes is a theme, that this actual union of Eros and Metta can be a challenge, but is very beautiful, very rich kind of love. But these are very powerful forces, and it's still, to me, a very, very much an open question whether there is something like sexual connection without attachment in the Buddhist sense, without the clinging and possessiveness and control. And I want to say there is. One can distill the Eros and the Metta from the clinging. And in that distillation, the Eros and the Metta are not diminished. You know, the love feels much richer. But whether that distillation can happen fully, I am honestly a little skeptical. And I think some of my maybe intrepid Dharma adventurer polyamorous friends would disagree or something, and that is, I think, what people are trying, or what people are doing that in a sincere way, are trying to find a way of loving that is freed of possessiveness. But I don't know. Open question whether that's possible. So many powerful forces, so much projection and idealization, infatuation, so much hope, you know, both realistic hopes for what love can do, and also kind of fantasies of what love can do. There's this particularly devastating line from a French psychoanalyst who sometimes say things like this. And it had a particular meaning within his system that is too complicated for me to understand, but we can make some sense of it here in the Buddhist context. This is Jacques Lacan speaking to this kind of the idealization, the ways in which our projections can complicate the gesture of love, and he said, love is giving something you don't have to someone who doesn't exist. Now, I almost feel guilty saying that out loud. And that is not the last word, but we can actually like take that in. Whoa, love is giving something you don't have to someone who doesn't exist. And as I say, that has a specialized meaning in his system, but the way that I, what's useful for me about that is that we can't be the end of seeking for another person. And they can't be the end of our seeking. And sometimes implicit in the love is this kind of sense, this promise that yes, this is, you are my end of seeking. And then the heartbreak. That love, as beautiful, powerful, redemptive as it is dukkha, not in the sense of that it's suffering, but that it cannot quench our deepest thirst. It can do so much for us, but it can't end the seeking. Lacan's also pointing here, I think, to the way in which our projections, constructions around the person actually can be so layered and so thick that it actually obscures who this person is. And I feel so humbled by the process by which we kind of have to keep coming back to the subjectivity of the other, like the radical otherness of that. You know, that you are not an object in my world. You exist independently. You have this whole inner life. And sometimes we get so myopic in the sphere of love and sexuality that the person just becomes a kind of screen for all of the projection, or they become a prop in this whole egoic play. And it's not just, I think it happens quite naturally. It's not blameworthy, but we have to keep coming back, like, oh, you are a separate being. Yeah. Like, you have this whole life of needs and wants, and I fit into your world in a certain way, you fit into mine, but we actually appreciate the otherness. There's a dukkha of being single and a dukkha of being in relationship. And that word dukkha is often translated suffering, but apparently dissatisfaction is better. And that's not to sound morbid. But my personal experience is that I've always been much more sensitive to the dukkha of relationship. And the dukkha of singlehood is less charged, it's been less intense for me. But all of us have our own relationship to that. We could say that some people believe that relationship is the solution to being single. And some people think that being single is the solution to relationship, right? But we're all wrong, you know. It's like the kinds of dukkha that arise in the relational realm are not accidents. They're not our fault, but they're not accidents either. You know, I suffer in very particular and meaningful ways in my relationship. And at the same time, relationship can't cure us of the ways in which dissatisfaction arises in being single, because our capacity to be alone in relationship is quite important. Maybe some of you know Tanisara and Kittisaro. I don't know exactly their background, but I think Kittisaro was in Thai forest tradition for many years, maybe 15 years in robes, and Tanisara was also monastic for a long period. And I think they met when they were in robes, and they fell in love. And they left, at some point, left the monastic traditions in which they trained and grew up in a certain way. And we're a couple. And I heard this recounted, Eugene Cash recounted a question that was asked of Kittisaro. He said the question was something like, you know, what is it like for somebody with so much, with both of you, with so much Dharma practiced, have been in robes for so long, to now be in, living a lay life and in relationship? And his response was that relationship is like two people being under one robe. It's a very beautiful evocation of the sharing that is relationship, the ways in which our joy and sorrow intermingle, and this calls on a lot of equanimity. Because my experience is sometimes the suffering of the other is more acute and painful for me than my own. To actually have to abide with compassion, but with equanimity too, is a very challenging practice. And I'm much more likely to be dysregulated by the suffering of my girlfriend than my own. Now, ultimately, that suffering is mine. All of it's mine, you know, in an important way. But the challenges of being both empathic and letting go, acknowledging one's limitations in resolving the suffering of another, that is very deep practice in relationship. So Richard Russo said in the novel Straight Man, "It was my opinion then and now that two people who love each other need not necessarily have the same dreams and aspirations, but they damn well ought to share the same nightmares. To love is to risk. To love is to risk. I think that's just inherent in the gesture. It is to risk. And of course we try to manage uncertainty and risk as best we can, and maybe some of those ways are wise, but it's complicated. To desire is, as Stephen Mitchell says, is to feel endangered. So this is Mitchell. Erotic passion destabilizes one's sense of self. When we find someone intensely arousing who makes possible unfamiliar experiences of ourselves and an otherness we find captivating, we're drawn into disorientation. We tend to want to control these experiences and the others who inspire them. Sustaining romance requires a struggle to resist the inevitable efforts to draw moving but unsettling experiences under our control. Our journey in the otherness of the other often surprises us with unknown features of ourselves. The journey into the otherness of the other surprises us with unknown features of ourselves. And this is part of the opportunity of relationship, is actually, in a certain way, we learn about different corners of the self, different aspects of our minds, different dimensions of our heart. And some of that learning, I feel, is truly unique to relational practice, and things that we just don't see in other spheres, no matter how diligently we sit. Love calls on us to dance in the knowing and not knowing, to develop some equanimity in the face of anicca, of impermanence. There's a kind of not knowing about how a relationship unfolds, and there's a not knowing as we look into the eyes of the other. And that same writer, Mitchell, says that a lot of times relationships sort of artificially construct familiarity, routine, the deadness that sometimes we complain of in relationship as a way of managing uncertainty, of managing the risk of love. And some of what we're asked to do is like, what is it like to not know? Can the heart stay open amidst the not knowing? Or is there a need for certainty and permanence in order to be happy? Anicca is always kind of shocking. Because, in a way, the default position of the mind is towards permanence. We're learning to negotiate our relationship with aggression. that love feels like so remote from aggression, and certainly metta is. But the aggression that seems almost inevitably to arise within the sphere of relationship, it's important that that's a spiritual matter for us to take deeply into the heart. And part of how I think about it is what we're trying to practice in such a way that our aggression becomes not eradicated, but it becomes safe for the other. That we can care for it, be accountable to aggression in such a way that it may still arise, but it's safe in us. It may still be expressed in different ways, but it's safe, that the other is truly safe even amidst that. Otto Kernberg said, love is the revelation of the other person's freedom. Love is the revelation of the other person's freedom. So again, speaks to that capacity to not know. We know the other so well, and that's beautiful. And can we look in their eyes and not know them, to actually sense the radical otherness of the other, the totally different matrix of concerns and needs, and there's of course lots of overlap, but can we see them, like, sense their freedom as another person to have other views, to make other choices, to continue to choose to be with us or not. Rilke says, emerging, a togetherness between two people is an impossibility. Where it seems to exist, it is a narrowing, a hemming in, a mutual compromised consent that really does limit one or both parties of their fullest freedom and development. But once the realization is accepted that even between the closest people, infinite distance continues to exist, a wonderful living side by side can grow up for them. If they can succeed in loving the expanse, loving the distance between them, which gives them the possibility of always seeing each other as a whole being before an immense wide sky. Think about the teachings on anatta, not fixating the self. But the corollary of the teachings on not self is not other. Often we fall in love with the other's self. We fall in love with the Atman. And that can be problematic. Because when we love them as something, it's a kind of clinging and fixation. and maybe violates the sense of the radical freedom, openness, impermanence of the other. And so just as we can be imprisoned by a fixated notion of self, a solidified sense of I am-ness, so too can we limit the other by fixating them as this, that. And some of the ways in which we can actually be kind is to open to the implications of the teachings on anatta as they relate to the other. Now, all of this to me feels much like a kind of adventure. And this is the Canadian writer Ian Brown. A short piece, reflection. He's describing his relationship to monogamy and his wife, and so he writes. He and his wife, we were having one of our gentle but ever so delicate chats about faithfulness when my wife said that the only thing she missed as a monogamous woman, at least I assume she was speaking as a monogamous woman, was newness, new bodies, new hands, new sex. I said I knew what she meant, and I said, but isn't that kind of sad? I mean, if you go through your whole life, 20, 30, 40, 60 years of marriage without ever straying, you do that, you never get to know what it's like to be unfaithful. You never get to know what it's like to feel emotionally illegal. And that's an important feeling, one of the great human themes, after all. A whole constellation of humanity you'll never know. My wife was quiet for a long time. And in the streetlight coming through the curtains, I could just barely see her outline. And I thought to myself, I've spent a long time in this bed. Yes, my wife said then, that's true. But if you do sleep around, you'll never know what it's like to be faithful to one person your whole life, which also might be an important constellation of humanity. There was just a touch of sarcasm in her voice. And then it was my turn to lie in the dark for a long time. I'd never considered monogamy as an adventure. I thought it was, well, domestic travel, where no international borders are crossed. But monogamy is an adventure, because trying to be faithful to one person is a trip that takes time. And you never really know if you're getting close or if you've reached the destination. You never really know when you've arrived. Just sit for a moment. Just becoming gently aware of how these words are reverberating or not. an opening with some tenderness to our own path in this realm. So may our life as a single person or in relationship be an aspect of Dharma, of our practice. And may that practice be a cause and condition for more freedom of heart for ourselves and others. So I wish you well. Nice to be together. Hope to see you around campus sometime.